Today's scripture reading comes from Matthew, chapter 2, verses 13 through 18. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said. "Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod, and so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted, because they are no more." The word of our Lord.
We, of course, are going through Matthew 1 and 2 for Christmas this year, talking about the grace of Christmas. And we've not really brought this out yet, but in this section of Matthew, there are a number of Old Testament quotations. There are five references, in fact, where Matthew says these things. They will call him Emmanuel, this line about, "But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah." Two lines here in today's passage, "Out of Egypt I called my son, and a voice is heard in Ramah." And next week we're going to look at this line where he says, "So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, he will be called a Nazarene." Five quotations of Old Testament prophecies. And we don't always realize this when we read through in our Advent readings, our devotional readings, but these quotations are generally not as easy as we might expect. Normally we think of Old Testament prophecies as sort of these predictions, just telling the future, you know, forward pointing. And then Matthew comes along and says, "Oh, this event, that's what that writer was really talking about." That's how we usually think about it. But it's not that simple in Matthew 1 and 2. There's something much different, something stranger going on. We are talking about Christmas morning today. And I want to point out, this is not morning like the opposite of evening. This is morning like sadness and grief. So it's morning with a U. And I just want you to know that's not a typo on your bulletin or on the slides. Morning with a U. Why talk about on Christmas, sadness and grief? What we're going to look at today, three things. We're going to look at, number one, the reality of Christmas morning, sadness. Then we're going to look at, number two, the reason for Christmas morning. And then number three, finally, the restoration from Christmas morning. Right? Christmas morning, the reality of it, the reason for it, the restoration from it. And so let's just begin with the reality. Right? The reality of sadness and grief associated with Christmas. And of course, sometimes with Christmas, things don't go the way we want. You know, when you're little, you don't get the present that you want, or you get the wrong present, it's the wrong toy, the wrong size, so you cry about it. There's sadness. And when we're older, we don't do that, hopefully. But sometimes things do happen that anger you at Christmas. You know, somebody does something, a family member, an in-law, they do something, you say, "Come on, it's Christmas. Can't we just get along?" Or maybe it's that there are families split in different states because of work or marriages, families that are spread far apart. Maybe it's a long-held tradition that just doesn't happen the way you think it should, and so there's some sadness, some grief with Christmas. But that's not really what I'm talking about today, those kinds of tears. And of course, that's not really what Matthew is talking about either. Philosophers use the word alienation to describe the sense that we have when things are not the way they're supposed to be. We feel alienated from what we want, from our dreams, from our hopes. And we set this up quite a bit 2 weeks ago. Matthew, throughout this section, has been talking about exile. Clearly, he builds his genealogy around it. He sneaks in this line at the end of chapter 1 about bringing her home for Christmas, the opposite of exile. But we get to the middle of chapter 2, and it comes up again. as Jesus and his family are whisked away in exile to Egypt, of all places, right? While home and family are utterly decimated for the people who remain back in Bethlehem. And what Matthew and what the whole biblical storyline is driving at is that there is something far bigger going on here than just those who happen to be on the wrong side of historical political tyrants. Verse 18. Verse 18 is this line, "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." Very poignant line. We're going to come back to it throughout our time together this morning. But this line, what it is referring to, this line appears three times in the Bible. Three times in Scripture, Rachel's tears come up. The first is way back in Genesis 35. The second time is in Jeremiah 31. And the third time, of course, is here in Matthew 2. Genesis, we will get to a little bit later. But in Jeremiah 31, you know what's happening? In Jeremiah 31, the people of Israel are being whisked away to exile, and Ramah was a staging ground along the way. People, Jerusalem had been sacked, people had been killed, they'd been put to death. Many of the other people who remain have been taken captive, and they're going to be shipped off to Babylon. And Jeremiah pictures Rachel, mother of Israel, weeping for all of her children who had either been killed or who are being taken captive at this refugee camp, this staging station where everyone's being gathered, put into shipments before being sent off. And Jeremiah poetically uses this image of Rachel weeping for her children to describe that moment of destruction, exile. And here in Matthew 2, as we saw last week, we have a vicious tyrant on a throne, sitting on a throne that's not rightfully his. Men from far away come asking where the real king is. Just a baby. Herod doesn't take kindly. An angel gets involved. An angel warns the Magi to flee in a dream. And then he warns Joseph in a dream to flee with the child and his mother, saying, "Go to Egypt, escape, stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for this child to kill him." And so they flee down to Egypt. And Herod, not sure who it is, but knowing that there is a prophecy that is mentioned, someone has been born to challenge his throne, decides just to have all of the baby boys under two put to death, just to make sure. Picture the families. Picture the fathers. Picture the mothers of these precious baby boys, weeping, crying. And Matthew picks up this line from the middle of Jeremiah and says it now finds its fullness in this situation of mothers upon mothers weeping over the loss of their children. Heavy stuff, isn't it? Why is it at Christmas? Mourning with a U. Well, years ago I heard a sermon that Tim Keller had done on that Jeremiah 31 passage. Not this one in Matthew 2, but the Jeremiah 31 passage that Matthew is quoting. And what I want to do is I want to give you a string of examples that Keller gave in that message. Because as we saw 2 weeks ago, with all of our work on what it means to be home for Christmas, this has far more to do, has to do with far more than just mere political tyranny. Eden was home for the human race. Eden, the Garden of Eden, God had made it to be a home for us, and we are no longer there. We are no longer in Eden. We're no longer at the home we were meant for. And to picture that, I want you to imagine this. Imagine that you are shipwrecked on Mars. You are a famous astronaut. You've been shipped off to Mars. You're shipwrecked on Mars. And you get out of your vessel, your helmet is destroyed, you get out of your vessel, exposed to the Martian atmosphere, and you take a deep breath of that wonderful Martian air. What would happen? Your lungs would begin to experience alienation. Right? What those philosophers mean when they talk about alienation is being separated from what was meant to sustain you, your lungs would start to experience physical breakdown. You would be in an environment that cannot support the physical function of your lungs. It doesn't suit you. It doesn't fit you. It doesn't sustain you. And so you would start to have physical alienation, and you would also have psychological and social alienation as well, because there's nobody else there. And you need other people. You were made to be around other people. You'd experience alienation because Mars isn't home. Right? Mars isn't home. You're not going to survive long. To be in an environment that is not home means it doesn't support who you are and who you were made to be. Here's a smaller example. You're in a hotel overnight. Right? You go on a business trip, vacation, you stay in a hotel. If you're just there for one night, you don't change anything in the room. You don't rearrange any of the furniture. But if you stay in a hotel for a month, maybe even a week, maybe even two or three nights, what do you start to do? You rearrange stuff, right? This footstool goes over here. This desk, this chair needs to move. You start rearranging things to suit you, to fit you, because you're living there. That's what it means to be home. When God created us, He put us in the Garden of Eden, the one place where our every capacity was absolutely met and provided for. We were meant for home, Eden. And we've lost it. Every single one of us, we've lost it. We've chosen to be our own lords. Went into exile, we lost the garden. We lost home. And Keller says, now go on to imagine this. Imagine that you are that shipwrecked astronaut on Mars. But imagine that you are a great mechanic. And so you begin to work on that spaceship and you get it working again, functioning again, and you make it back to Earth. Right? You don't have to take that deep breath of Martian air. You get back on your ship, you make it back to Earth, and you step out of your spaceship on Earth, and you take that deep breath of our air, and you say, I made it home. I've made it back. I made it home. But are you? Are you home? On Mars, you would die very quickly. On Earth? Oh, it's going to be slower, but you're still going to die. You're still dying. Even this world cannot sustain who you were meant to be. You're going to break down. You are breaking down. How could this be home? It can't sustain you. There was a man named Albert Camus, philosopher. And Camus said this. This is a long quote. Bear with me. We'll break it down as we go. Camus said, if we stop and think about it, beauty in our world, beauty is unbearable. Beauty drives us to despair. He was a little pessimistic, all right, but hang with me. Beauty drives us to despair because it offers us for a minute the glimpse of an eternity that we desperately want to stretch out over all of time. But we do not have that consolation. To put it in a nutshell, why do we have an eagerness? He's talking about loving others, loving a spouse, seeking a job, seeking meaning and all of these different things on earth. He says, to put it in a nutshell, why do we have an eagerness to live in limbs of a lover, to live in limbs that are destined to rot? For most men, the approach of dinner, the arrival of a letter, or a smile from a passing girl are enough to help them get around it. But the man who digs into ideas finds that being face to face with the fact of death, the reality of the rotting of the one and the ones that you love, being face to face with the fact of death gives rise to disgust and revulsion, and this revolt of the body is what we call nausea. He's saying nobody wants to face the implications of death. We don't want to think about it. So we pursue all of these other pleasures instead. Love and food and travel. The movie The Lion King tries to make death seem natural. You remember? The circle of life. When you die, the Lion King says, you become fertilizer. And out of that fertilizer, plants and flowers grow. And other animals come along and they eat those plants and flowers and they have new life. And then sooner or later, they die and they become fertilizer. And on we go. Isn't it beautiful? Isn't it wonderful? It's the Lion King. And Camus says, have the guts, have the honesty to look it square in the eye and say, no, that is not lovely at all. That is not lovely. A world in which everyone you love is going to become fertilizer, and then you will, or vice versa, whichever comes first, a world like that cannot be home. A world where everyone who will ever hear of anything you have ever done will sooner or later be no more, will rot. That is a world that does not fit us. It does not suit us. It does not suit the deepest longings and desires of your heart. We all have longings for love that will last, not disappear. We all have longings to do something that really matters, that makes a difference, that will not be wiped away through the grains of time. And the world where everything disappears cannot be home to those deepest desires we have. And so we mourn for it. The reality of Christmas morning. We've never had the home that we all long for. Instead, we have a collective longing for Eden. In Psalm 90 begins, O Lord, you have been our dwelling place. We all long for that. The great hymn by Isaac Watts, you've been our eternal home. He is the home that you have been missing, the home you're longing for. In Eden, God walking with the man and the woman in the cool of the day. It's what we remember collectively. It's what we are trying to get to and we can't. And that shapes absolutely everything that you do. Now, Keller says, avoid the naivety that Camus is talking about. Don't just bounce through life saying, well, if I just had this lover, this spouse, or if I just got this job, or I just had this house, then all of my desires would be fulfilled. Don't do that. But he says, but also don't be despondent. C.S. Lewis had this line where he said, hunger does not automatically provide food. If you are hungry, the reality of that hunger does not automatically give you food, but it proves. The hunger proves that there is such a thing as food. If you're hungry, there must be food that you're hungering after. If you are just the product of a material universe, why don't you feel at home in it? If materialism is all that there is, why aren't you satisfied with it? Why does your heart long for something deeper? He says, do fish complain about the sea for getting wet? We feel wet when we get into water because we are not aquatic creatures. Right? But fish are aquatic creatures, so they don't complain about being wet. Why don't you feel at home here? The only possible explanation is real home was something else. Real home is somewhere else. Right? Don't be naive thinking things in this world will satisfy, but don't be despondent because your desire for it points to it must be out there somewhere. But understand what the reality of your mourning, your longing means. Now, 2. This section will have to be a little bit shorter. The reason for Christmas morning. The reason. Some of the harder lessons in life take more than one time to learn. Right? What we are doing today is very similar to what we did 2 weeks ago with being home for Christmas. Why are we doing it a second time so quickly? Did you ever have to learn a lesson a second time? Did you ever have to relearn something? Graham is right at the stage where he is starting to say compound words, right? To put strings of more than one word together. And so we're starting to get polar bear, not just bear. The simplest phrase is hat on, fall down. It's wonderful, right? It's wonderful. We're starting to teach him more complex things because of that. And so we're working on the idea of you and me. You and me. And really, I don't have a clue how you teach a child the difference between them. I think it's a minor miracle that any of us ever learned you and me. Because if I say to him, you, me, And he points to himself and says, you, me. It's wrong. It's backwards. And if I reverse it, he still gets it wrong. How did any of us ever learn the difference between you and me? It's a miracle. I know he'll get there. Right? We all get there. Just perspective of the speaker. But we're working on it. One of the other things that we are working on is saying thank you. Simple idea, just saying thank you. You know, we give him something we know he wants, and come on, thank you. Other people give him something he wants. Let's say thanks. Say thank you. What's happening is every time we give him something we know he wants, we are saying, say thank you, here you go. And so what he is learning is whenever you give something to someone, you say thank you. All right. This is, the other day I came home from work, earlier this week, came home from work. Graham comes running down the hallway, and he holds out his hand to give me something. And so I reach out my hand, and he throws it in my arm, and throws it in my hand and says, thank you, and runs away. And so I open my hand, and what was in my hand? It was little. It was brown. Now, there is a short list of words you are not allowed to say from the pulpit. Danielle and I had a very long discussion about whether I could tell you the name of what it was that he gave me. But I will say it was something his own body produced. Fortunately, it was hard and not mushy. Thank you, and runs away. There it is. We're working on it. We're making progress. The depressing thing is that 10 years from now, that story is the only thing you will remember from this sermon. And I would like to make a deal with you that you only tell Graham that I told you that story when he is 12, if you can remember the point that goes with it. When you remember that illustration 10 years from now, what in the world was he talking about? Remember this. Some lessons take more than one time to learn. You are in exile, and you're waiting to get home. You're longing to be home, but right now, the reality we live in is homelessness. Matthew has been painting a picture of the reality of exile. Here are just a few thoughts on the reasons behind. Sin, by its very nature, drives you out. Here's an example. When you lie to somebody, when you lie to a friend, that action on its own is the beginning of the end of the friendship. Because when you lie to somebody, in the future, you cannot be fully honest with them. You have to start thinking about, what do I need to say to cover up that lie that I told before? I need to not reveal what I'm trying to hide. And so the lie on its own introduces alienation between you and that friend. It's the beginning of the end of the friendship. If you lie to your spouse, it's the beginning of the end, if not of the marriage, it's the beginning of the end of a healthy marriage, and quite likely the beginning of the end of the marriage itself. Sin, by its very nature, casts you out. It exiles you. But also, when you sin, you are in need, you are deserving of judgment from outside of you. The action itself introduces alienation and exile, but also now there is somebody outside of you who has the right to judge you. And this is why the Israelite people had a scapegoat. In the Old Testament law, the Israelite people had a scapegoat, and they would place all of the guilt on this animal. They would lay the hands on the animal to symbolize all of their sin, all of their guilt is now represented here, and then they would drive it away. They would drive it outside of the camp, outside of the community, symbolizing the result that always comes from sin. This driving out is what the biblical exiles are always emblematic of, and you cannot get back home. Now, here are a few examples of how much you can never get home, you never get back from the end of these exiles. Throughout the prophets writing through this time of exile, here's Ezekiel 36. Ezekiel says for God, I will take you out of the nations. I will gather you from all the countries and bring you back into your own land. I'll bring you back. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. The desolate land will be cultivated instead of lying desolate in the sight of all who pass through. And they will say, this land that was laid waste has become like the Garden of Eden. Well, that never happened after the exile. The end of exile did come about. The Israelites were brought back home. But that verse never came true. What the exiles are always pointing to, we never see the end of throughout the Old Testament. Isaiah 35, speaking of exile, the ransom of the Lord will return. They'll enter Zion with singing. The desert and the parched land will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom. Then will the eyes of the blind be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped. Well, that never happened. Then will the lame leap like a deer, and the mute tongue shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the desert and streams in the wilderness. Elsewhere, Isaiah wrote about the wolf will lie down with the lamb. Here's one more from Isaiah. In that day, when the exile really is finished, in that day Israel will be but the third, along with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing on the earth. The Lord Almighty will bless them, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, my handiwork, and Israel, my inheritance. The prophets are writing, even the ones who are doing the exile, the prophets are saying they are in exile as well, the entire human race. Even the exilers need an end to the exile. In Psalm 87, I will record Rahab and Babylon among those who acknowledge me, Philistia too and Tyre, along with Cush, and I will say this one was born in Zion. The Old Testament prophets give us these descriptions about a return from exile that are so over the top that the actual literal return 70 years later was never actually fulfilled, never touched what these prophets were talking about. Israel coming back was great. It was important. But in a way, it was only an image of a far deeper lesson. All human beings were made for a home that we have lost and we are waiting for. When God says, I'm going to heal you of your exile, it's not just to Israel. It is to the entire human race. The punishment is always to be kicked out. We're never able to get back on our own. So how can you get back into the loving arms of God, the face of God that you're longing for? And the answer is the tears of Rachel. Rachel's tears. Restoration from mourning, restoration brought about by mourning. The tears of Rachel. Look, number three, the restoration. Verse 15, this line about, out of Egypt I called my son, that is a quotation from Hosea 11. The thing is, Hosea 11 is not a messianic chapter. It was not a messianic prophecy. All of the scholars who read Hosea 11, none of them read it thinking it pointed forward to the Messiah. Everyone who read it said this is pointing backwards to the captivity in Egypt and how God brought them out. It's pointing backwards, not forward. And Matthew comes along and says that all of Israel's history and all of Israel's mission is picked up and fulfilled in a deeper way in the life of Christ. It's pointing backwards, but it's recapitulated, it's brought about in a fuller way in the life of Christ. And that framework is very helpful as we go into verse 17. As I said, Rachel's tears are mentioned three times in Scripture. In Genesis 35, Jacob is on his way home. He had been separated from his family. He's coming back home to his family. Would have been very excited about it in Genesis 35. And in Genesis 35, on his way home, very tragically, his wife, Rachel, his beloved wife, goes into labor, gives birth to her second son, and dies in her labor, in her work, in her pain, giving life so her child could live. And she named him, and she wept, and she died. Genesis 35. It's quoted in Jeremiah 31 in connection with the people going off to exile, and it's quoted here in Matthew 2. Rachel's tears are the tears of every person who has ever wept over the spiritual inhospitality of this world to your deepest desires? Rachel's tears are the tears of every person who has ever wept over the spiritual inhospitality of this world to your deepest desire to have a love that lasts. Every mother who picks up a baby, and we don't like to think about this, but every mother who picks up a baby, either that baby will watch that mother die, or that mother will watch that baby die. It's one or the other. Go there. Because only then will you realize this world as it is not your home any more than Mars, to your deepest desires for love that lasts. And Matthew says, a voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, mother weeping for her children, and says, this is fulfilled. It is brought to an end. Jesus fulfills this. How did it happen? He made himself a wanderer, a homeless wanderer, as we saw 2 weeks ago. He kicks off his life having to flee to a foreign country. And at the end of his life, he heads for Jerusalem. Luke 19 tells us he wept over Jerusalem. He wept. And Matthew, in his parallel passage, in Matthew 23, says, Jesus said, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, as a mother. But you were not willing. And he wept for the children who were lost. Now, this is metaphorical language. It's not confusing anything about Jesus' gender or his identity or his sexuality, but it is mighty bold in the Gospels. We have the Messiah weeping like a mother. Like a mother. Deliberately weeping like a mother, referring to himself as a mother whose children are lost. Why? Because he is the ultimate Rachel, dying in his labor to give birth to his offspring. Hebrews 13 tells us, that points out that where the cross was outside the city, outside the gate. He's the scapegoat, cast out to bring you in. He's the mother weeping over his child, refusing to be comforted, going into ultimate exile so you and I could be brought back. The best mothers, the best fathers, the best homes on earth are but an echo of this. And only when you realize that this is what you are looking for, until then you'll spend your entire life looking for all the wrong things. It won't last.